Hello, I am your host, Juliet, and I'm here with my co-host, Haley.
Hi.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind health, rehabilitation, and neuroscience researchers. Through a series of interviews, we will discover the different paths these researchers took to get to where they are today and the impact of their research. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. Today we are here joined with another fantastic PhD student in our lab, Teresa.
Hi.
Teresa, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So my name's Teresa Gaughan. I'm a third year PhD student in the Faculty of Health, and I'm originally from Mississauga, Ontario. I've been in Halifax for over 10 years now.
On the podcast, we like to do a little rapid fire, this or that, and we'll be collecting a little poll after based on the lab members' quick responses. So you're not supposed to think about these ones, just like the first one that pops into your head, okay?
Okay.
Okay, pineapple or no pineapple on pizza?
Pineapple.
Donair sauce or no Donair sauce?
No Donair sauce.
Musculoskeletal or musculoskeletal?
Musculoskeletal, because it's fancy.
Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Red or blue?
Red.
Okay, this one you can expand on. If you had $1 million, what would you do with it?
Oh my gosh, I think I would buy property. Really boring. This is going to be boring. I would buy property and then invest the rest.
Smart. On our last episode, Juliet was saying how that's what a lot of people should do if they win $1 million.
It's not that much money anymore. It's
yeah,
just not.
It's true.
You can't retire on it.
Even with $1 million, like, you're not going to be buying anything fancy.
No.
So I don't know what the housing market is like in Halifax, but I know that in Vancouver and Toronto, $1 million won't get you very far. So
I think here it's starting to also be pretty competitive in that way.
Yeah, but good thing I don't work in the housing market, because I think that would stress me out way too much.
I think also as a student, it stresses you out trying to find a place to live that's reasonably priced.
Yeah, I got really lucky with my living situation. It was like a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend that I ended up moving in with. And I don't know how else I would have found my place, to be honest, or a place to live.
Yeah, like if you don't have mice in your apartment or your house, you are a lucky person. That's all I have to say to you. Luckily, I never personally lived in one, but I had some friends who did in second year. And it was so funny because they would have to have like the little sticky mouse traps on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And every once in a while, someone would accidentally step in one.
Oh my gosh.
And they would catch themselves.
Yeah.
So there's been many times I've had to remove sticky traps. And then my roommate's cat also got stuck in one.
Oh no.
And she's long hair. So then they had to like use, I can't remember if they used Dawn dish soap, and they had to like bathe her to like get like her unstuck.
Oh dear. I can't say that my house is rid of mice because Frank does find them in the middle of the night, and he likes to show us his cool little gifts that he found, and so that's really cool. But my roommates wake up before I do, so I never actually have to see the gifts that he leaves for us.
Does he leave the gifts in her room or their room?
No, I think he leaves them in the kitchen most of the time. But I did hear that one time he wanted to befriend the mouse, so he like injured it, and then he was like playing with it, and you're like, no,
oh,
Frank.
No.
You can do better than this, Frank.
I know that, well, what one of my friends said, that if you have a cat and the cat catches a mouse and it'll present it to its favorite person.
It's like a gift, like, here you go.
Like, good job. Look what I did, mommy. Or father.
Or the cat just calls everyone mommy.
Yes. Parental unit. I have conquered this place, keeping it secure. But yeah, she found, this might be a little bit too graphic, but she found the insides on her clothes on the ground, because I guess she had like taken her clothes off because she had to do like a quick change. Yeah, the next morning she woke up and
devastating.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe this just goes to show that maybe I'm not Frank's favorite, but not disappointed by it either, because I don't think I want any mice friends showing up on my clothes.
Or pieces of mice friends.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
Well, back to you, Teresa. Not sure if you've had any mice in your house, but
thankfully, right now I don't.
That is good. That is very nice. And I'm wondering, was there a major turning point or influence that is the reason that you chose to pursue research?
Yeah. So in my second year of my psychology neuroscience degree at Dal, I took a class with Olav Kruggelsen, actually, which I know Juliet. You know?
Yeah, shout out to Olaf.
Yes, shout out Olaf. And it was his intro to cognitive science or psychology class. And the way that he did it was he would give us a list of questions and we had to pick three out of like the six questions and prepare basically like an introduction to a research study for our exam, and we'd have to come in knowing like all the references, all of our points, and then we'd come into the exam like no papers or anything and just write. And I remember I really enjoyed that because I liked kind of going off on my own and doing that like back end of the research where you're synthesizing the information and collecting all of the ideas and then coming up with a study, which I find is like a very creative process for me. And so, yeah, after doing that, I was like, oh, wow, this is research. It's not just like a beaker and sitting at a bench and mixing chemicals. So, yeah, that I would say is like the pivotal point where I first got into the idea of maybe research is an avenue I would explore.
And that was in your undergraduate or master's?
My undergrad, yeah.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't have too different of an experience from you in that Olav Kruggelsen, I can give him credit for getting me into research. And it was actually a very similar course that I took with him that he then advertised his lab to me. And then he really impressed me with his teaching skills. And yes. So through that, I joined his lab. And then I ended up doing like a summer research position that really got me into research. But he definitely has a different way of learning and teaching, and I think he's won like many different teaching awards for his style of teaching.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, it's very unconventional. So for those listeners out there who is unfamiliar with an Olav Kruggelsen class, basically he gives a predetermined list of questions that you need to answer over the course of the semester. And each week you have a quiz on one of four questions that is randomly assigned based on a dice. So it's assumed that you're going to do the readings and the work to answer these questions, but you, at the end of the day, you could gamble and just do one of the questions and hope that it lands on that one, but no one really does that. And then when you get to your midterm, all the questions that you have answered during the quizzes are then compiled and you randomly get four questions again of the, I don't know, 24 that you've already answered. And then when you get to the final exam, it's like a compilation of three questions that to answer each question correctly, you need to have had all the, I don't know, at this point, 48 questions answered. Anyways, this is a long way to say that he's a big believer in repetitive learning, whereby you keep coming back to the same ideas over and over again. So what you see in a quiz, you see in the midterm. What you see on the midterm, you see at the final exam. And he even encourages students to rewrite exams with that intent of repetitively having you interact with the material. And so his theory always is if you run into him 5 years down the line, he could ask you the question of, what is motor learning? And you should be able to give him an answer. So it's different. It's a lot of work on both parts, a lot of writing and a lot of marking. So
I think that's really interesting because I know a lot of first year courses, and I'm so sorry here, but psych, I love Jennifer Stamp's classes. I loved her. I thought she was an amazing prof. I still think that to this day. But I feel as though the only thing that I remember is Pavlov's study.
Yeah.
Like, ring the bell, dog drools, ring the bell, dog drools. Like, that's all I remember. And, like, I think it's just, like, the multiple choice, like, and having to remember or think and then apply all those theories used in multiple choice scenarios. I feel like I didn't really retain any information.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really interesting way of doing it.
Yeah. I would say my only advice for it is it maybe takes a bit more of an advanced student to really grasp the idea well, because we were responsible, like you said, Teresa, to read all these research papers, which for me at a second year level, I found very difficult to do, especially when it's on, you know, classical conditioning and you're looking at dopamine responses. And here I am, like, I don't know, I know the raisin bun model for an atom, but I can't read like a dopamine graph. I find it very difficult. So
I think it also kind of just goes to show that you're supposed to be, or at university, you're expected to be responsible for your learning and continuing to want to move forward with that. Because also in the real world too, you're going to have situations like that where nobody's going to sit here and tell you, okay, you need to do this, 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 and this, right? You have to take that initiative and really kind of go with it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think Olaf kind of drills that point home by letting students redo their exams if they think they can get a better grade and improve what they wrote.
Mm-hmm. It kind of gives a lot of purpose to the student. It's like you now are competing against your previous self, which, you know, we like to encourage.
Teresa, what path did you take to get to your PhD? So honors, master's?
So actually, after the Olaf Krogelsen class, sorry for butchering your last name, Olaf, I did a directed studies in my third year with Dr. Tracy Taylor Helmick. She's in like the memory world. She was a student of Ray Klein's, and she has her own lab now at Dal for quite a long time. So I joined her lab doing a directed study, and I also kind of credit her to a lot of not only like my journey of science, but having a real understanding for the background that goes into it. I know there's various students in various labs that obviously different labs have different approaches of how they handle undergrad students doing research. Tracy was very much like, you are starting bottom up. You are doing the coding for this. You are doing the analysis for this. You are doing the participants. You are doing everything to get exposed to it. If you want to do research, you need to know everything. And I really appreciate that because she has like a gentle, strong approach. So she really pushes you forward, but she's always there to support. So I did that in my undergrad. And then I continued on with her just because I had an amazing experience. So I did my honors with her in directed forgetting too, which directed forgetting is basically just telling someone to forget something that they saw and seeing whether they can intentionally forget it. So I did that. And then I crossed paths with Sarah Kreutner, who is now at UBC Okanagan, and she was a student in Sean's lab, master's student at the time, and she was a TA in two of my classes, and she was talking about her research, kind of like recruiting volunteers, and so I went to her, and I was like, I'd be really interested in volunteering, so I started volunteering in the lab, and then Sean and I did a fourth year directed studies program, as I did my honors with Tracy. And then I was like, I love this lab and I love the community. I love the work. I'm really interested in a lot of the questions that they're asking. And so I decided to start my master's. And my master's was in action observation and motor imagery, basically looking at, we did a repetitive like dart throwing task, a learning model. So it was over a period of 2 weeks, six sessions where people would throw darts, either physically, motor imagery, action observation, which we can get into that later, or a combination of the two. And unfortunately, COVID happened in the middle of my master's. So that project never really saw its full potential. And I had to do a scoping review, which is not as fun, but you know, it's informative in its own way.
So you got poached by Sean.
Yes, exactly.
He always gets them.
He does, yeah.
Yeah, I like the approach of your third year directed studies / honors supervisor of making you do everything from the ground up. I feel like maybe you found it super beneficial going into your master's and now your PhD to have that coding background and having to, I'm assuming, build your research study from the bottom.
Yeah, definitely. Even when I was in the honors course at Dal, I found doing the directed studies course, I was like, I knew how to, you know, I only did it once, but I had a better understanding of how to, like, do my ethics, submit my ethics. There was a lot of people in the class who didn't even have to do their ethics. And I was like, okay, like, you know, everyone's on their own journey. But it definitely helped me knowing that I was going to go forward doing a master's and a PhD where I'd have to do all those things myself.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like it allows you to be a bit of a better mentor now that you're in your PhD because you understand all the different little ins and outs of making a research project, like doing ethics applications, which a lot of people can skip over when doing an honors project.
Yeah, definitely.
So just another follow-up question here. How many directed studies did you do in your undergraduate? Because I'm trying to do the math right now, and I was like, huh?
So I did a directed study in third year. I did my honors in fourth year, and then I did a directed study with Sean in fourth year.
So you're doing two projects simultaneously in your fourth year?
Yes.
Did you sleep?
Yes and no. But my directed study with Sean was more of like a directed reading. Like we did a scoping review on, oh gosh, I don't even know what it was on. Something to a stroke.
It was a scoping review.
It was a scoping review. That's all you need to know.
Yeah. Well, honestly,
bonus points if the audience here can go and find it.
Yes. Yeah. I honestly think that directed studies is very overlooked in undergrad. It looks different from university to university and even from program to program. But personally, I did 3 directed studies in my undergrad, and they were probably some of my favorite courses I've ever done. And I really liked the self-guided nature of them and the opportunity to kind of explore a topic that I was interested in instead of some sort of predetermined course that they told me I was supposed to be interested in, but most of the time I was not interested in. So it's a really good avenue to check out if you are interested, I guess. I don't know. How did you find your way into these directed studies? I know it was a long time ago, but.
So for my first one in third year, I emailed a couple. I think gonna just drop names who didn't respond to me. I emailed Dr. Corkum, Penny Corkum. Is she still here? No, maybe not.
Cannot confirm.
Who knows? I emailed her. I emailed Ray Klein, and he's the one who was like, oh, my lab's pretty full, but like Tracy was my student, and she does like adjunct type of stuff. So I emailed Tracy, and I think I emailed her like 2 or 3 times. She finally responded and was like, yeah, let's meet. And then yeah, the rest was history. And then Sarah was kind of my connection to Sean. I spoke to Sarah. I like had a short meeting with her, and then I had my short meeting with Sean, and I went on and volunteered. And then I said to Sean, like, I want to kind of do more in the lab than just collect data. And that's when we came up with the fourth year directed study.
Nice. Yeah, that seems about right. Always don't be afraid to send several emails, yeah, because 9 out of 10 times someone is not ignoring you on purpose. So
it just gets lost, like the amount of emails Sean must get.
Yeah.
It just gets lost.
I actually, after I got my first publication, I started to understand a little bit about like getting spam emails, because it's like I was getting several emails being like, send your article to our journal for social sciences. And I was like, well, maybe no. Or they're like, we've published your article. And I'm like, maybe you haven't. So I can only imagine the number of publications he's gotten to at this point, like the amount of spam emails he has in his email. I'm curious to know how many that is.
Yeah,
I think it's so funny because now anytime I email Sean with like anything that is like, hey, we need to talk about this, or we need to get this done for like my honors, and he's like, hey, email it to me by this day, we'll get it done. I always, I know, do high priority. Because I'm like, Janet, please make sure Sean gets this.
That's
smart.
That's a very smart move. I should start doing that.
Might as well use technology to your advantage.
Exactly.
I've started flagging my emails so I don't ghost people, but I still find, hi, I'm not really following up. Like, maybe that's what I'll do after this. I'll go through my flagged emails and reply.
I feel like it's been 6 months. Oh, shoot. I was supposed to respond to that like 3 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I definitely do still sometimes, like 2 weeks after an email, I'll like think about it. I'm like, did I ever respond to that? And then I go back and I'm like, no, I didn't. 2 weeks later, I will respond to it. So I should have a better system. Honestly, email should create something that makes it easier for me, you know?
Maybe, yeah.
Actually,
for no. You specifically, Juliet.
I was going to say, maybe I am the problem. I am the problem, but I can, if email wants to, you know, sponsor us and then also...
Email?
the email.
All emails. Okay, Yahoo, do you Google, want, yeah.
Yes.
Like, what do you want? Do you want Gmail specifically? She do you want Outlook?
You know, I'm really looking for Hotmail, actually. So if Hotmail could sponsor me and improve, you know, I don't even use a Hotmail account. I don't know why.
But back in the day.
I did, actually.
It's like, hey, girl, what's your email?
Yeah. My email. I don't know if you guys are comfortable sharing your, like, junior high emails, but mine was Talkaholic.
Talk.
Like Talkaholic, like I talked a lot.
Oh, okay.
At hotmail.ca. So send me an email. Actually, don't. Please don't. I can't get into it anymore, so.
My mom was like, you can't have anything that's identifying.
Name. Same with my parents.
Because I think I got this in, like, grade 5, my email. I don't know why we had to get an email in grade 5. I can't remember. Anyway, so we basically just found, like, it was like, what should I call my email? Like, we literally Googled this. And for some reason, DJ and then, like, insert, like, part of your name was always the response. And so I was like, so I tried, like, DJ, like, the letters DJ and then HAY at Gmail. And it didn't work. So there's an extra letter in there, but it does contain DJ, random letter, and then hey. So if you can figure it out.
Try all the letters in the alphabet, and you can get a contact with Haley.
I actually don't respond to that email ever. It's just my spam one. So like if it's like, oh, please subscribe to this, I'm like,
yeah,
okay,
you
I
enter
use
that one. Yeah.
But for the longest time, my grandparents were emailing me on it. And they're like, why don't you respond to me? And I was like, oh, I don't use that email anymore. So please use my, like, actual Gmail. Yeah. But then that also just didn't end up working. I don't check that one either. Yeah. So I'm like, you know what? If it's important, send it to me, to my Dell one.
Yeah. I felt really bad because the UVic email system is, like, really hidden in their website. And it's not as easy as just using Outlook, it like we have at Dell. And one of my friends had sent me, like, an invitation to fill out a form that they needed to have complete for their med school application, but they sent it to my UVic email, so I didn't see it until, like, 2 months later, which was definitely a bad thing, but also, if you're going to send me something like that, please let me know which email you're sending it to.
Yeah. Or even say, like, hey, I sent you the email. Can you confirm you got it?
Yeah.
And then that way you can be like, no, I didn't get it. What email did you send it to?
I did fill it out, though. I don't know. Just note, this friend did get into med school, so I didn't hold them back. But, anyways, going back to your kind of journey to your PhD, I am really curious to know, what is action observation and how does it differ from motor imagery? Motor imagery being the imagination of movement.
So action observation, it's literally in the title, which is nice about these terms. It's basically when someone is observing someone else doing an action. So like if I were to observe you picking up a cup. And so the cool thing about action observation is that research has found it activates the same neurons in your brain that are responsible for that movement, called mirror neurons. So if I was doing a movement like picking up a cup, the neurons that are active would be the exact same neurons that are active if I was only just watching Juliet pick up that cup. So it primes the brain in a way versus motor imagery, which is more of a top-down process where you have the action and then you kind of go into the details. Action observation is at the bottom of the process, your motor neurons are turned on and then you start filling in the details. Okay, what's Juliet doing? She's picking up the cup. How is she grasping the cup? How is, you know, what is the goal of this movement? So you could think of motor imagery as a top-down process and action observation as a bottom-up process, essentially.
Very cool. I remember learning about action observation for the first time in, what a surprise, Krigolson's class? Anyways, when I first...
Krigolson sponsored this podcast.
You know, he has his own podcast, too, so maybe...
I'm not surprised.
Maybe it's a paired...
Collab question mark?
We'll see. Anyways, so when I first learned about action observation, I was like... really deep into my dance journey, and I really wanted to be a better dancer. And I was like, well, if my mirror neurons are firing, can I just watch professional dancers all the time and then become better? And I don't know, I don't think I did get better, but in my brain I was like, yeah, if I can watch this person doing a backflip, I will be able to do a backflip.
I don't know why, but that was exactly what I pictured. I just pictured Julian trying to do a backflip. not trying, but you know what I mean? Like, has never attempted before. She's like I've watched like 1,000 videos. And then she like just goes, oops, ow.
Wait, I'm so curious. What was your dance journey?
Well, my dance journey was just like, my dance journey is quite interesting, I like to think, because I didn't start dance until grade 8. So that was really late compared to other people, because most people started dance in age 3, which I don't know what grade that is associated with, like kindergarten or something. And so I was really, really, really bad at dance to begin with. And so I ended up dancing from grade 8 all the way to grade 12. And I did things like ballet, jazz. I was a big fan of jazz and modern. And then I eventually did make my way up to point, but I was really bad at it. I even, like, one class just started crying because everyone else was doing things so flawlessly, and I could not even get on my toes. I was like, I literally don't understand how I'm supposed to put my weight on my toes. But anyways, I guess it's not as interesting as I thought it was.
You're like, I watched the videos of everyone going on their point, and I thought I could do it, and now I can't.
Yeah, there's actually this one YouTube video. I'm going to butcher this guy's name, but I think his name is Michael Damsky or something. And he has this really incredible compilation of all the dances that he did. And they were so good. And it's like an 8-minute video. And I watched it over and over and over and over again. And I was like, maybe I'll be able to do this. And at some point in his video, he literally like flies in the air and then does like a front somersault. And, you know, I can't do that. So it didn't work. But I think action observation is not really used in that context, correct, Teresa?
I would say correct. I'm not an expert, but I would say correct.
Yeah. It is interesting, though. Like, do you have any inputs or knowledge on what's more effective for motor skill acquisition?
So that's kind of all over the place, honestly.
Yeah.
So when I did finish my master's doing the scoping review, we looked at cortical spinal excitability. And a lot of papers do find that there's more cortical spinal excitability with action observation, which does make sense because we don't really know what's going on with motor imagery, but at least with action observation, we know it's triggering the mirror neurons and they are active. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actual skill acquisition and learning, it really, everything's all over the place. And I feel like it's hard. Even like doing a scoping review, comparing action observation versus motor imagery or the combination of the two, which is a very hot topic. It's hard because you're like, you're not exactly comparing apples to oranges, but you're comparing like Fuji apples to like Macintosh apples, you know, like if one person's doing motor imagery and action observation of a basketball task versus someone else who's just doing motor imagery and action observation of like cup stacking, like those are very different tasks. The instructions, whether it's like passive observation or active observation, whether someone's maybe even unintentionally doing imagery during their observation when they're not supposed to be, just because it's like natural, you know, so it's hard to kind of come to a conclusion when studies are so vast in their differences of like methodology as well as instruction, as well as just who knows what anyone's doing when they're doing motor imagery. We like to think we do, but we don't.
Yeah, it's also, it is an interesting idea because even though in a lab setting you can, you know, tease apart action observation and motor imagery and kind of test them independently, I feel like most of the time you're using them in conjunction in real life examples. Like, as a dancer, I was always watching the person perform before me. Like, if we were doing an across the floor combination, I'd watch the person in front of me, I'd be observing their actions, and then I would also be imagining myself doing it at the same time. So it was like, which one am I doing? Action yeah. observation or motor imagery? I don't know. And maybe it's probably likely that there are brain regions that overlap
yes, for both. Yes, there is, yeah.
So it's really hard to tease apart the two.
Yeah, and another thing that's kind of a hot topic in that area is when people are doing like simultaneous action observation and motor imagery, is it really simultaneous? Are you like switching? Are you putting more of your focus towards watching someone do the dance number and then you're doing the motor imagery of yourself and then switching back to like focusing on observing again? Mm-hmm. Or are you actually doing it like you layering it simultaneously?
Mm-hmm. I think that's just a hot topic generally. I remember having one of my elementary school teachers like yell at me. I think it was because I was sanitizing my hands at the same time as like listening to their lecture, and they were like, research shows that multitasking does not exist, and you know, you can only attend to one thing at a time. And I was like, does research show that? Because I'm listening to you scold me while I'm still sanitizing my hands. So
you're like, actually, I'm just blocking you out, yeah. turning off my hearing because I don't want to listen to this.
Yeah, I don't know, but it is a hot topic. I remember learning about it in psychology, the idea of multitasking and whether or not we can or cannot do it. It's hard to say.
I wonder, too, if it's kind of almost like a generational thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I know, like, obviously multitasking for some people is hard, but I don't know why, and my grandma would always get mad at me as a kid for doing this, but, like, let's say I would be basically multitasking. I would have to have the TV on.
Yeah.
And I'd be doing something else, and she'd go and turn off the TV. And I was like, why'd you turn it off? I was listening to that. But you weren't watching it. I was like, it doesn't matter. Yeah. I'm still listening to it.
I was the exact same. Like, I always had – this is so weird. When I would get home from school, I would do my homework with the weather network in the background. And it, like, repeats every 30 minutes. And I would just listen to it. And for some reason, it was just like – it was almost like a soundtrack in the background, you know? But yeah. It wasn't distracting me.
Yeah, that's really – I feel like I do very similar things. I have this app on my phone, and it's, like, the world's most easiest game ever. It's like Tetris, except you get to choose where the blocks go. And so whenever I'm, like, watching a TV show and there's, like, a lot happening, but, like, visually it's pretty slow, I find it easier to watch, like, TV shows, movies, or even when I'm engaging in some conversations to have my attention on this video game while – or it's not mm-hmm. a video game, it's, I don't know, an iPhone game – while, like, listening to the conversation at hand versus I, like, lose attention if I just don't have that distraction. I don't know. It's kind of weird. Yeah,
that's interesting. It's almost like you have to be – it's almost like being fully engaged, even though you're not fully engaged in the conversation. Your brain's still at a level of engagement that you're able to focus on the conversation. Mm-hmm. Versus if you weren't doing that game, maybe like your mind would just wander. And
yeah, and it honestly, shout out to that game. I have a ridiculously high score in it, so it's quite a fun one.
A humble flex.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not so humble.
Maybe this is when Ernest says cocky. Who knows?
Yes.
That was kind of like a big transition for me coming to university, because in high school, whenever I would study, I would always be, or like doing schoolwork, I would be sitting at the kitchen table because I had a desk in my room, but I just found it so isolating and way yeah. too quiet that I would try and almost do other things to keep my mind stimulated. And so, yeah, I'd sit in the kitchen, my mom would be cooking dinner, my dad would be talking to her, and then the TV would be on, watching the news. And so I'd just be sitting there and like doing, and I felt so productive. And even now I have to at least be having some level of like music, even if it's turned really low, or the TV on again, yeah. just really low, in order for me to feel productive and actually like do a lot of yeah. work, which I find is so weird. And my dad, when I was younger in high school, he was like, if you're studying for an exam, you can't do that. Like, you have to do like
be in complete, the headspace.
Yeah, be in complete silence. But I actually also found that sometimes if I was like doing the exam and I forgot what the question, like the answer to the question, I would almost remember what was going
on.
Like
an association. That's interesting.
I think I think the ADHD brain really came through there.
Well, that's like a whole idea. It's a style of learning. I'm forgetting the name.
To like pair things with like a microphone.
Around. To like pair things around like with a room in order to remember. Yeah, I forget what it's called.
Yeah, I learned it in the context of grocery shopping. It's like if you need to remember a list, put things on your grocery shopping list on the route that you take to school. So like if you're leaving your house, on the path you see a watermelon, and then on the bus stop you see your bananas, and like et cetera, et cetera. And then when you walk through this path, you kind of remember and you associate the location with the grocery item list. But kind of on a similar note, Haley, podcasts for me, well, it's actually not very similar, but anyways, when I wake up...
Same, but different.
same, but different. When I wake up and my mind is awake, but my body is really tired, I actually put on a podcast to kind of, like, let my mind do whatever it wants to do, but then I can still fall back asleep. But I find it's, like, the most effective way for me, specifically... to get that extra hour of sleep. Is that related? Maybe that's not related at all.
This is just a fun fact about Juliet.
It seemed related. You
know, here's my experience with this, Juliet. So when I was young, I remember like my mom, she would have to take the bus into work, and she worked downtown. So we had to leave the house at like 6:30 in the morning. So getting a kid up, and like obviously she'd have to drop me off at daycare. Yeah. And so I remember my favorite show would be on at like 5 in the morning, which was Kim Possible.
Oh. Shout out Kim Possible.
Yeah. And so I remember my mom would wake me up. And so in order for me to actually like fully wake up for the day, I would like get up with her. I'd walk into her room because she had a TV in her room. And she'd put sunglasses on me. Because it was still so bright. And I'd sit there and watch Kim Possible and eat my breakfast.
Okay.
Oh my god.
Yeah, that visual. Oh my gosh.
Same, but different. I think the thing that cued my mind was like background noise. And I was like, oh yeah, background noise, like my podcast that I listen to in the morning, which I should give a shout out to my favorite podcast. It's The Armchair Expert with Dax Shepard. I honestly know nothing about Dax Shepard as an actor, but I love his podcast.
I was going to say, that sounds really familiar, that name. I am horrible with actors' names.
Yeah,
me
too.
It's the character, or I could like know what they look like, but I don't know their name. And so people be like, oh, you know, like Tom Cruise. I know, obviously, know who Tom Cruise is, but Tom Cruise. And I'm just like, nope. They're like, okay, you know, like they'll say some random movie that probably isn't even popular or, you know, or like not mainstream. And I'm like, okay, still don't know, but okay. I was like, you show me a picture. And I'm like, oh, you know, I think a lot of people have that issue.
Yeah. Well, Dax Shepard, I don't even think I've seen anything with him in it, but
his wife, Kristen Bell.
Know who you're talking about now. Yeah. I love Kristen Bell.
Yeah. So I think that's probably how I got into the podcast in the first place, but he's a great podcast.
He really does.
I like it.
See, you know, was that like an association thing, Teresa?
The podcast?
No, Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard. See, I know the wife.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Maybe.
Do a study on me. How Haley's mind works. Okay, Teresa, we want to just further ask you to expand on why action observation is important.
So one of the problems with motor imagery is we don't know how well someone's doing motor imagery. Like, we have all of our motor imagery assessments, but I mean, a 4 out of 5 to someone could be someone else's 1 out of 5. So it's really hard to measure motor imagery and whether someone's doing it well, as well as a lot of the applications for motor imagery can be for people who have brain injuries, such as stroke. And it could be hard for them or really fatiguing for them to be doing a lot of motor imagery. So by doing action observation, even if it's passive action observation with those mirror neurons being turned on, that really primes the brain and gives it an environment to essentially heal. I know that's not the correct word, but to essentially make those connections again that are necessary between the neurons. As we all know, neurons that fire together wire together.
I was just going to say that.
Shout out Heb.
Yes, Heb actually studied at Dell.
Yes, he did. We are very proud of that, I think.
We are buds. I've never met him.
But we're buds by association.
Exactly. By association.
Yes.
So smart. So smart.
Yeah. So that's action observation. That's why it's important. It has a lot of applicabilities in anything from recreational, like Juliet watching her dance videos, to a stroke patient who really can't engage in motor imagery or is very fatigued from motor imagery. It gives them another avenue to do rehabilitation through.
That sounds very, very cool. I'm so in the motor imagery world that I wouldn't even really think about the negatives of imagery, because I'm like, imagery can do so much. And it's really true. If you have a brain injury and if it's extremely fatiguing, it can be a very difficult rehabilitation tool to use. So bringing in action observation seems like a really good next step for research.
Yeah, definitely.
So I am curious, because this is your master's research. So what is your current role in research now?
So for my PhD, I've stepped away from action observation and I'm focusing on motor imagery. So specifically, I'm interested in how we learn. My overarching PhD question, I guess, is like, how is it that we're learning through motor imagery? And I've kind of broken it down. Like, we know when we learn a movement or an action through traditional, like actually just doing physical practice, that there's errors that we make and we acknowledge those errors, we have feedback, and we have the like whole error loop of like correction, detection and correction mechanisms in order to improve our movements and perfect our skill. Except for motor imagery, we have no idea really what's going on, as we mentioned earlier. So my research is looking at kind of parsing out that process that we know is there in physical practice, but we're not exactly sure what's happening during motor imagery. So my PhD project I'm working on right now is looking at the presence of error in motor imagery. So whether when people are imagining a movement, if they're imagining error, and if error then predicts later learning or better learning.
Yeah, that's, I think that I do have errors when I use motor imagery in a kind of everyday life situation, because right now I am really into rock climbing, and a big thing about rock climbing is you'll see people standing on the mats just kind of like working out their climb in their heads. And sometimes, you know, I'll imagine myself doing a foot swap and then I look at the route again and I'm like, no, I shouldn't be doing a foot swap here. And then I go back and then I instead do a flag or something. And so it wouldn't be surprising to me if errors were present in imagery.
Yeah.
I actually find it really hard to do motor imagery sometimes. Mm-hmm. I think it's, for me, it's almost like trial and error. Like, yeah, for rock climbing, I've gone with Juliet and she has seen me just go get there and I'm like, yeah, no, and I just like fall off. I'm like, we'll assess this in a second, but I'm just like, I'm more of like that trial and error, like,
yeah,
physically,
have to physically be doing
in order
it
for me to, yeah.
And I think that kind of comes down to experience, because it's still a topic being explored in motor imagery, but there's definitely a difference between someone asking me to imagine myself doing a backflip versus someone asking me to imagine myself, I don't know, doing like a front punch, a jab in boxing or something, you know? It's like, I know how to do that. So imagining myself doing that is not too difficult for myself. So
yeah, I think familiarity is definitely something that is like being looked at in motor imagery, and definitely makes sense that the more you're familiar with the components of the movement, the easier it may be for you to imagine doing it.
Yeah. And so for your research then, are you using a skill that the individuals would have been familiar with in the past, or is it supposed to be like a new skill? Or is there's a motor learning skill?
Yes, there's motor. Yes, yes. Okay. It is a learning paradigm.
Okay.
So yeah, it's 5 days of doing Trace Lab, which has been used in our lab quite a lot, and it's basically everyone knows how to trace things with their fingers. So in the sense of doing motor imagery of, you know, moving your finger, it's not a new skill, but it is a new skill in the sense that you're learning a novel shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very, very cool. I think that, you know, I think in terms of the practical uses of imagery, having this sort of familiarity is not necessarily a bad sort of confounding factor, because at the end of the day, if you're learning to rehabilitate a skill, it's presumed that maybe you have had this skill in the past and you are now trying to strengthen it due to some sort of injury. So hopefully the whole experience thing doesn't, you know, limit an individual's ability to learn the skill that they're trying to now newly obtain. So, but as Olav said, repetition is learning. So yes. Hopefully with the rehabilitation routine as well, there is some sort of repetition to gain proficiency in the skill, but also in imagery.
If you could give your younger self any advice regarding your academic path, what would you tell young Teresa?
I think there's two things. One is, when I look back, I'm very fortunate to have been surrounded by good researchers who are also just good people. And I find when you stick with those people, they are also surrounding themselves with other good people. So for instance, just meeting Sarah and her being supervised by Sean, and then Sean's environment in the lab, it's, you know, a very collaborative space. And I don't think I would be able to do research successfully if I was like in a basement somewhere with like two other people who didn't really want to talk to me about the research, and it was very like narrow-minded focus, versus I find our lab's very collaborative and helpful, and we're all really excited about what we're doing and supportive. So I'd just say, you know, stick with the people who are there to support you and who are also good people. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing I would say, and this is also just coming from experience of TAing first year students, and I am guilty of this in my first year, don't take anything too seriously. Like, at the end of the day, think about the worst case scenario. It's really not that bad. Like, whether you get a B or a C or an A, like, it's just first year psychology. Don't take anything too seriously. Have fun. Work hard, but have fun. And at the end of the day, worst case scenario, you redo the course. It's mm-hmm. not that big of a deal.
Yeah, that's a big one. I think I took things way too seriously. Yeah. And when I got into my fourth year or something, I kind of had this reflection moment where I was like, I actually can't remember any of the things that really brought me down in my first year. And the fact that I can't remember tells me that they really weren't that important. And so sometimes I like to think about, if something's really weighing me down and I think it's the biggest, most important thing in the entire world, I'm literally like, nobody else feels like that but me. So maybe it's not as important as I make it out to be. But
yeah.
It keeps me in check sometimes, and other times maybe it makes me a bit lazy, so we'll see.
I feel like that's a later-ish.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really good advice, though. I think the surrounding yourself with people that not only inspire you, but you get along well with is really important. And don't be hard on yourself if you are in a lab and you don't really vibe with the other people in the lab. It might just not be the place for you. And yeah, that's okay. And it might be a place for somebody else. Like, you don't have to discourage people from joining that specific lab per se, but you might find growth in other places, and that's okay.
And that's something Jen Stamp told us in one of her courses. She was like, there are people who love and thrive off being in like a dark room by themselves, not having human interaction, and just doing like the like really cellular neuroscience, not having human participants. And that's amazing, because then those of us who don't want to do that don't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, definitely not discouraging other people just because it's not your environment. It could be someone else's environment, and you just have to figure out what works for you, which is a great part about directed studies, is that you can meet different supervisors and kind of see how they function and, you know, decide your path from there.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast today, Teresa.
Of course.
It was so interesting to learn about action observation and then just incidentally coming across associations, even though we forgot the name of it. But and your motor imagery error-based learning research sounds very interesting, and I wish you good luck with it.
Thank you.
Up next, Hudson's Hot Take of the Week.
Drivers should have to learn how to drive a manual transmission car before they're able to get a driver's license. In addition to looking cool, people who can drive manual transmission are better drivers. They must pay attention to their own surroundings and the actions of other drivers on the road in order to shift gears properly and avoid stalling. Saying that you're a good driver without knowing how to drive a manual transmission is like saying you're a good cook without knowing how to use a stove. It's like trying to make a fancy meal with just a microwave and a toaster. Sure, you can make something, but it's not going to be a five-star dish. Plus, if a third pedal and wiggling your right hand every so often throws you off, maybe you shouldn't be operating a multi-ton piece of heavy equipment quite yet.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I'm your host, Juliet.
And I'm your co-host, Haley.
And this was recorded at CKDU.